Hello, this is Sue Lloyd, Vice Chair of the ISSB, and I'm here today with our Chair, Emmanuel Faber. This time we're recording this podcast virtually, following our virtual March board meeting, and we're going to talk about some recent events, insights from our March board meeting, and a bit of a look ahead to what's coming up for the ISSB. So Emmanuel, I'll hand over to you. Where do you want to start?
Thank you, Sue. Welcome, everyone, to the ISSB Monthly Dog and Pony Show. Sue, thanks for being with me for this. And I think there are many, many events in this in our space right now. But of course, one that is, I think, capturing a lot of attention is the EU Omnibus announcement that took place on February 26th, which attracts attention, as I just said, not only in the EU, but way beyond for many reasons. So I won't go into any of the details, obviously, but the EU Commission has proposed to simplify the EU rules and to boost competitiveness. I have to say that we completely remain committed to working in close cooperation with our European counterparts to maintain and possibly further enhance alignment between ESRS and the ISSB's global baseline of sustainability disclosures. We believe that the interoperability mechanism that we have jointly published with EFRAG could further be simplified without taking any of its substance, and therefore we look forward to engaging in this process in the next several months. What we continue to see in Europe and outside is that companies, investors, market regulators advocate for the global alignment in sustainability disclosure standards. So the building block approach that we have adopted from inception with interoperability on the basis of the baseline helps to meet the needs of investors as well as broader stakeholder groups. So stay tuned with that, because obviously that's going to be an important aspect of our work. Interoperability is critical to what we do, and we'll keep you updated with this. One of the areas where we're making good progress is around transition plan disclosures, which is also connected to this interoperability situation and potential with the EU. And maybe Sue, you could tell us a bit more about this.
Sure. So we're making good progress here with a small but mighty staff team taking the lead. So just to give us the context again for the transition plan disclosures, of course, our climate standard IFRS S2 already requires companies to provide disclosures about transition plans, and really to support those using the standard, we're in the process of developing IFRS Foundation educational material about those potential disclosures, essentially examples of what those disclosures might look like. So to inform the work that we're doing there, which is building on the work of the TPT that we took responsibility for last year, we've hosted several stakeholder events to gather information from our stakeholders to inform the work that we are doing. And what we're doing there has been looking for input from different jurisdictional perspectives, including from those involved in establishing our disclosure requirements in various jurisdictions, but also getting input from the investor perspective and the corporate perspective as we do this work. And what we really want is confirmation of how we should go about tailoring these TPT materials to make sure that the guidance that we produce is suitable to support the application of IFRS S2, and then it's going to be really useful for those in the market, including, for example, as Emmanuel said, giving the potential for jurisdictions like the EU to refer to these materials as a baseline for transition plan disclosures. So coming from those stakeholder events, there was generally agreement that the foundation should develop a guidance document building on these TPT materials, and that that would be a good way to reduce the cost and complexity for preparers who are seeking to comply with the requirements to disclose information about transition planning. They also agreed with our direction of travel, where we have planned to omit some of the aspects of these TPT disclosure materials where they relate to sort of normative or policy orientated or UK jurisdiction specific statements to make sure this is really truly globally applicable and that it really focuses on disclosures about transition plans consistent with the requirements in S2 and also the policy neutral position of the ISSB. And in that regard, one of the useful suggestions that came up in those discussions was that we make it clear in these materials that they can be built upon. So if a jurisdiction, for example, has a policy position on transition planning, that they could, point that out and add to the disclosures that we include in our materials. We also receive some really useful suggestions to consider other tools to support the implementation of S2, such as illustrative examples, templates, and resources for small and medium-sized entities. So really helpful. Thanks for everybody who was involved in those discussions. For others, there's a summary of this feedback that's available on our website. We're going to keep engaging with our stakeholders as we develop these materials, and we hope to publish these late in the second quarter of 2025. So good progress there, and I think that should be really useful material once we publish it. So this week, of course, is Board Week. So Emmanuel, let me hand over to you to talk maybe about our research projects and what we talked about this week.
Yeah, sure. Thank you, Sue. And that was indeed a digital week for this time. We actually went through both the research projects and the SASB on which you might want to speak, Sue. But interestingly for me, this was a very clear, concrete evidence how the two are interrelated and actually nourish each other. And I think both the papers are really showing this, and as well as the comments that were made by board members. So I'm emerging from that board week with this reassuring feeling, in a way, that we have a very consistent overall agenda from a technical standpoint now in supporting the implementation of S1 and S2 as a priority with this research and the SASB announcements as well. On the research, we are also entering a really interesting phase because we are basically moving, and that was the pivot conversation from several months where the team and the staff have been collecting the dots about what exists in terms of framework, what is evidence of investors' interest, and many other dots, to a connecting all those dots, as we will start to probably do starting next month and going forward. So it's really interesting to see this funnel, and that we are now going to enter into what might become proposals for proper standard setting around these topics. The phase one of our research had four pillars, basically: evidence of investor interests and the limits thereof, evidence of effects on an entity's prospects and the limits thereof and why and how, existing standards and frameworks, and the current state of disclosure. And we basically learned a lot about how overall current disclosures are quite mixed. Investors have highlighted the need for better information, not just for more information, and maybe not, sometimes not about more information, actually. We also learned that the effects of an entity's prospect can vary on the entity's industry, its business model, I would even say on its location, that was very clear in several cases, but also on its dependencies on nature and human capital, as we were exploring biodiversity and human capital separately. What was also really interesting is that the database that were used, the samples of thousands of reporters' data, were both from the thousands of the SASB reporters and the thousands of a much broader population of companies. And we were able to look again at how some part of this research agenda can actually be approached through a an industry specific way. And so with that, Sue, I would turn probably for you to say a few words about the SASB standards, unless you have anything else you wanted to add on the research.
No, I think you did a good job there on the research. And yeah, for me also, it was really interesting to see the connections between these research projects and the SASB enhancements. And as a SASB board advisor, you know, I'm involved in the deep dive into the planned enhancements, and I can really see the connections and the work, which is great to see. But just to recap for listeners, we're working on enhancements and making proposed amendments to the SASB standards. And we had an update of the progress of that project, and also an opportunity to really update the full board on some of the sort of more structural or strategic decisions underpinning those proposals, to really give the board an opportunity to ensure that we've got the benefit of the board as a whole providing input to the strategy that's then implemented by the board advisors with this working with the staff. And as people might remember, we decided back, I think, in July last year to prioritise 12 industries that we expect to issue exposure drafts on before the end of the year. And indeed, 9 of those exposure drafts should be ready for publication around the end of June. And it's a really super important process here, because the SASB standards are really fantastic support for the application of S1 in particular. So if you look at S1, it asks you to provide information about essentially all of the important sustainability related risks and opportunities that would be material and for your investors to understand. And the SASB standards are a fabulous proportionate way for a company with particular industry or activities to look at the SASB standards and identify, okay, those are the sorts of risks and opportunities to focus on, and these are good disclosures to meet that need. So there's a really important connection with our work on supporting application of S1 and S2. And in fact, that was one of the really important design sort of ideas that we're working with, that we confirmed with the board, working on the assumption that when we look at these SASB standards, it's within the context of these being materials that are designed to be used in combination with S1 and S2. And we're actually planning to issue a sort of guide that would accompany the SASB standards, that would also go out with the exposure drafts to explain how you do that. So, for example, that the concept of materiality is the same when you use the SASB standards, that the concepts of disaggregation are the same. And when you think about value chain, you need to think about value chain when you're using the SASB standards. It also shows us how we use the SASB standards to really complement S1 and S2. So if I look at greenhouse gas emissions disclosures, for example, in some industries, having particular information about methane emissions is important. So you can really see in these SASB standards how it complements S1 and S2. Also, to the point that Emmanuel was making, we've seen in the work that we've been doing on biodiversity and nature, for example, that there are particular industries where that's important. And you can see that coming through in these SASB enhancements, or particular information about, say, work and safety in some industries is coming through. And that's really resonating with what we're seeing in the research on bees and human capital. And last but not least, in terms of design, what's really important here is opportunities to improve interoperability. So one of the things the staff were talking about was how they're looking at sort of corresponding disclosures in the GRI standards and in ESRS, and really looking for opportunities to align the exact wording and disclosures just to make it easier for companies to apply our standards in combination with those other sets of literature. The other thing we talk about is the fact that we propose to ask a question about whether we should signify that these SASB industry standards have been enhanced and have been through the IFRS Foundation due process by changing the name and the way that we reference the SASB standards that have been subject to this amendment process. And that brings me to the due process. One of the really important things about the SASB standards is their status within our literature. Nobody's required to use the SASB standards when they apply S1 and S2. We ask companies to refer to and consider the SASB standards because we think they're really helpful for companies to apply the standards and result in really useful information for investors, but they're not required to be used. They're effectively illustrative examples. So that means we have a slightly different process. The full board ratifies the final ED and approves it for publication. And importantly for stakeholders, I think the punchline is exposure drafts will be issued in the normal way with the full 120-day comment period and all of the usual information, basis for conclusions, and the opportunity for everybody. And we hope lots and lots of our stakeholders to give us feedback on these documents to inform the re-deliberations as we finalise this work to update and enhance the SASB standards. So that was board week. So let's look ahead, Emmanuel. And I think next things coming up, importantly, we've got a few busy weeks coming up on the regulatory front. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, thank you, Sue. And I would like to just maybe start from a helicopter view on the fact that the capacity building around the application, the adoption first, and the application and implementation of the IFRS sustainability disclosure standards has always been something that the foundation wanted to be on the front foot of. We are a standard setter organization, but we fully acknowledge that this is a very, very new language and that we cannot just stop and posting, you know, and let the general public and market participants look at this new language. So capacity building and support to both the regulatory and the voluntary use of the standards has always been, since inception, a priority for us. About not even a year ago, in May of last year, we issued a jurisdictional adoption guide at IOSCO's general meeting. And by that time, there were 20 jurisdictions that had already committed to adopt or use, and the fact was that all were actually committed to adopt the standards. We are not even a year after, and these are 36 jurisdictions now. And in the meantime, the Global Emerging Market Committee of IOSCO has announced in Ankara last December, only a couple of months ago, that they would create an ISSB adoption network for their members that would be willing to consider the adoption. And that group has been joined by about 20 additional jurisdictions. And so the urgency for us and the need to ensure that all these jurisdictions have what they need to develop their thinking and then their implementation of the regulatory adoption or the use is critical and timely. And this is why we had committed that we would develop tools to help them. And next week, on the 26th of March, we will actually launch our jurisdiction roadmap development tool with accompanying illustrative roadmap templates. That is an interactive, comprehensive tool that offers four jurisdictions scalable support to help them navigate the main consideration and decision points that they are likely to arise as they develop a detailed project plan for adopting or otherwise using ISSB standards. So there are already a number of jurisdictions with which we are engaging on bilateral basis, and we'll be able to be even more efficient with that that tool here. And I'm also thrilled that the Qatar meeting of the GMC, the Global Emerging Market Committee of IOSCO, will be the opportunity to have a second meeting of the committee's adoption network. And of course, that roadmap development tool will be extremely useful to start structuring the thinking of all these regulators that are thinking about how to implement our standards. So indeed, looking forward to further collaborations with all the jurisdictional authorities and our many partner organizations that support jurisdictions on their journey and to see the far-reaching impacts of this tool. That is what we do on the regulatory part of things. But of course, we want to also speak directly to how The preparers and the market is going to be ready, and maybe Sue can let us know a bit more about what we do right now about this.
Sure. So we continue to be really active in terms of thinking about ways that we can help those who are using our standards. So one of the things that we're doing, following on from the information guide that we published in November last year about materiality, to use that definition broadly, we are following up with a webcast that will cover really an overview of this guide and how companies can use the guide both to identify sustainability related risks and opportunities and to determine what material information to disclose. And the webcast goes through some practical examples from the guide, explaining the definition of material information that we use, what sustainability related risks and opportunities are and how a company can identify them, how to use this ISSB standards to identify and disclose material information about those sustainability related risks and opportunities, and also highlights some aspects of connectivity with the financial statements and the work of the ISSB, and also interoperability concepts with the work undertaken by Europe and ESRS and by GRI. So I know that sometimes for me, listening to people talk about things can be a really helpful way to get up to speed with materials. So really hoping that this webcast series, which will be on our website soon, is a useful complement to those written materials that we published back in November. The other thing that we're working hard on is the exposure draft that we plan to publish in, I think, late April, with a 60-day comment period, where we're proposing some targeted amendments to some parts of S2 to deal with aspects of disclosures about greenhouse gas emissions, some clarifications and some additional reliefs, you'll be pleased to hear. So this is in the area of financed emissions, so clarifying the scope of the financed emissions that need to be included in the measurement to make it clear that you don't need to include greenhouse gas emissions for derivatives and for facilitated and insurance associated emissions. Also for those with financed emissions who are in the bank, have commercial banking activities or insurance, proposing some changes to the disaggregation requirements for industry classification, so that it won't always be the case that you'd need to use the GICS or Global Industry Classification standard for that disaggregation, and extending some of the jurisdictional relief to make it clear that if a part of your entity is required to use a measurement method under the other than the GHG protocol corporate standard, that the part of the entity could use the jurisdictional measurement, and making it clear also that if your jurisdiction requires you to use a global warming potential value that's different to the one that we specify in S2, that there would be relief to enable you to use that jurisdictional value. So a series of things that we really hope will simplify application for a number of entities, and also provide additional clarification. So look out for that exposure draft, 60-day comment period, and we really look forward to hearing from you. And for me, looking out the next couple of weeks, I'm looking forward to being in Tokyo in early April, looking positive that I might be there for cherry blossoms, which is a bonus for me personally. But on the work front, I'll be there with an anchor event, which is our Integrated Thinking and Reporting Conference, which will take place on the 3rd of April in Tokyo. So I hope some of you listening can join us there. At that conference, there'll be representatives from the IFRS Foundation's leadership. So I'll be there with my counterpart, Linda Mizon-Hutter, along with some of our other staff and important members of that integrated reporting community. Also with, of course, important Japanese stakeholders and international stakeholders, to really talk about an area that's a great passion for many, the adoption of integrated thinking, integrated reporting, and how you can use those frameworks along with the IFRS accounting standards and the ISSB standards. And it's a great time there to be there for me, because it is around the time that we should hopefully be able to comment on the alignment between the SSBJ standards and our standards. So it'll be great to be in Japan in person for some of those discussions. And that, I think, is enough from me, Emmanuel.
Thank you, Sue. That was a lot. And all the best for Sakura in Tokyo. It's a lovely season. It all depends on what the temperature will be in the region in the next couple of weeks. So stay tuned for that. Maybe some LinkedIn photos of that lovely meeting that you'll have there. Next month, we will meet in our Frankfurt office for our board week. We've learned last time that among the attributes of the brand of this podcast, there is the voice of Stu Lloyd. And if you want to hear it again soon, just stay tuned with us and we'll be there. Thank you.
For the latest developments from either the International Sustainability Standards Board or the International Accounting Standards Board, make sure to subscribe on the IFRS Foundation website, www.ifrs.org. If you enjoyed this podcast, please take some time to rate, review, and subscribe on your preferred podcast player.